Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Nishit Desai Roundtable Conference Call on Amendments to Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code, Potential Impact on Creditors, Investors, and Litigants. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vyapak Desai. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thanks a lot. Thank you and welcome all the participants to this conference call. This is once again, we are coming back to this audience. Last year, we did about five such conference calls and an interactive session with many, many participants. This year, we thought that this would be the best opportunity to regroup, particularly with the 2019 amendments to the code itself have been passed by one of the houses in the parliament. The way this government is functioning, I don't think it will take too long for them to pass laws. Therefore, we thought that we need to be quick enough as the government itself. To that, we thought that it may be ideal to have this roundtable today itself, while this law is still not come into effect. As mentioned, this is almost a fourth amendment to the code itself in less than 2 years of the code coming into force. There are more than 8 to 9 amendments to regulations and many more clarifications and jurisprudence coming out of several NCLTs, and Supreme Court. So, as a starting point, this code also is in a way reactionary, and in a way, you know, government trying to address some of the concerns which are arising out of the practical experiences coming out of cases like SR, Binani, and many more. While SR is still under adjudication before Supreme Court, some of the provisions under this code also addresses the points raised before the Supreme Court itself and may settle some of those disputes in that form and manner. So with that introduction, let me introduce the panelist or my colleagues here who would be participating on this roundtable teleconference. So I have Simon Rees, who heads the M&A and restructuring practice at Nishit Desai Associates. She's been involved in several of this matter from various stakeholders. So she will give her perspective of her experience and how these amendments would make things easier or difficult for stakeholders looking at IBC as a potential deal tool. We also have Arjun Gupta, who is a senior member of our international litigation and investigation practice. He especially focuses on the restructuring and IBC as a special practice. And we also have Kamran Mohammed from our Delhi office. He is also a senior member of our international litigation and investigation practice. So with that introduction, may I go to Arjun to give, or Kamran maybe, to give a little snapshot of what these amendments are, and then we can, you know, go further down analyzing one or two of them, considering the time frame here. And we'll also keep a longish time frame for comments, views, and questions for this audience. While the webinar says we'll go all the way up to 3:15 in terms of our discussion, but we intend to open up the floor much earlier, so please hang on. Over to you, Kamran.
Thanks, Vyapak, and hello everyone tuned in. So let me just divide these amendments into three buckets, so to say. They can be totally good, well-received, and long-awaited amendments Then there are some amendments which may need more clarification, and then there are some amendments that are slightly controversial. So let me just talk about the ones which are well received and definitely required. And I think one of the key and the first one among them was more of a clarification in nature, where the definition of resolution plan was amended. And it was amended to include to say that it will now include provisions for restructuring the corporate debtor by way of a merger, amalgamation, or demerger. Now we've seen, one of the very first resolution plans that came out, Synergies Dure Automotive. That was one instance where the company was contemplated to be merged after the resolution plan. Another instance was Monetis Path. The statement and object of the amendment say that this is to encourage more dynamic resolution plans from the market, and we definitely hope that this will achieve that purpose. The second amendment, and that was again very well received amendment, is with respect to how the resolution plan now becomes binding on the government and the government authorities. We saw in the past how the governments had, in some cases challenged the methods by which their dues were being paid under a resolution plan. And with this amendment to make the resolution plan binding on the government and government authorities, we expect this will reduce some litigation around it and also expedite the process of implementation of the resolution plan. Another key amendment is with respect, and which is again well received, is with respect to initiation of or going into liquidation at any stage after the commencement or constitution of COC. This was very much required in cases where companies never really had much of a business to continue as a going concern, or in cases where chances of revival were not there at all. So with this amendment, we can now directly, or the COC can now directly proceed to the liquidation. Now, talking about some amendment or one amendment which where a little more clarification would be helpful is with respect to the timelines. The amendments now propose that there will be a mandatorily 330-day time limit to complete the process of insolvency resolution. And this will now also include all the litigation time or the time which was taken in any other litigation proceedings that were taken out during the process of insolvency resolution. It remains to be seen how this will play out practically. There have been instances where Supreme Court, a proceeding gets filed and the Supreme Court sends that proceeding back to the COC for reappreciation. Many a times it is sent back to NCLT. Sometimes there is a stay on corporate insolvency resolution process. So it will be seen as it remains to be seen how the stakeholders, litigants, and parties in those proceedings now act to complete the CIR process within the 330-day timeline. And now, so these were some of the amendments that have been good and maybe require more clarifications. And I would like to now go to Arjun to talk about some of the controversial amendments that have now come up.
Kamran, not so much as controversial, but maybe requiring a little bit more clarity, is one of the amendments which deals with the concept of voting mechanism for class of creditors. The Insolvency Code had gone through an earlier amendment by which the concept of class of creditors was introduced, by which it was said that security holders and deposit holders who have a trustee or an agent appointed on their behalf would act as an authorized representative for them and participate in the resolution process on their behalf as a single point of contact between the resolution professional who is in charge of the corporate debtor and this particular category. The other category was every other creditor who is above 10 creditors and they belong to a particular class, for example, home buyers. They all belong to the class of home buyers. They're more than 10, then they'll be bunched into this category called home buyers, and they will in turn be represented by an authorized representative who is appointed by the resolution professional of the corporate debtor. the problem which we have seen to surface for class of characters is that for many resolution processes, these particular classes have not been participating in the same fashion and manner as the rest of the committee of creditors. So in these situations, sometimes the committee of creditors, which requires a 51 or a 66% vote to pass resolutions, do not get this threshold because of the lack of participation of certain individual categories and members of classes. In order to get through with this difficulty, the current amendment basically proposes a separate voting for each class of creditors, where a majority or a 50% voting of those who actually submit their votes would be enough to convey the decision for each class, which means that if there is a class which has a yes with 50% present and voting, then the entire class conveys that to the resolution professional, who will take that through to the COC.
So instead of Arjun, let's say there are 10 creditors in a particular class. Now, instead of going to each of them, there would be a authorized representative who will go to that 10. And so long as 6 of those 10 says yes, then their total value of vote would be yes for all 10.
That's
so
right.
Far as the larger 66% majority is concerned.
That's
so,
right.
Comment on that. Is this a welcome move? Will this give less opportunity to the dissenting ones, or how do
sure,
you see it?
Sure. So from the perspective of ensuring that the CIRP process itself doesn't stagnate and stall because of lack of participation, yes, there had to be some kind of a mechanism which had to be figured out. But there are some other issues which need further clarification as well. For example, if we take debenture holders, for example, who have already an agreement by which they have a mechanism to provide their consensus with respect to any decision being taken by their authorized representative, which in many cases, like we see, is based on a 75% voting threshold. Now, because of this statutory amendment, the debenture holders will actually have to deal with a 50% majority vote, where whatever 50% say, that ends up being imposed on the rest of the 50% as well. Now, coming to the question of individual voters. Now, if I'm an individual voter who has maybe 10% of a class and I am overruled by the other 50%, or even 40% being overruled by the other 50%, then my view, which could have percolated down to the rest of the COC and merged up there, thereby having a larger impact on the decision being taken by the larger COC, might not come to the forefront. Now, that is something which we'll have to see how exactly it works and how maybe the different classes are going to react to this kind of a change in the voting mechanism.
Sure. This would definitely be helpful in cases of home buyers as a class and maybe similar situation creditors. Maybe
Absolutely.
There is also an amendment with regard to the dissenting creditors
sure.
As part of the voting arrangement,
yeah.
And also in terms of how the sale proceeds to operational creditors would go. Can you give a little idea as to
sure.
what does it mean?
Sure. So now we actually move to those parts of the amendments which most probably are going to get most debated at various forums, including courts maybe in the future. So one of the amendments to the code actually deals with the amount payable to various categories of creditors. And the categories that they are dealing with are operational creditors and dissenting financial creditors. To deal with operational creditors, first, operational creditors have been provided with a mechanism by which a floor price has been prescribed, which is to be payable to them, which would either be the liquidation value of the company when distributed as per the distribution waterfall prescribed in the liquidation mechanism, or the resolution plan proceed when distributed as per the liquidation waterfall mechanism, whichever is higher. And with respect to dissenting financial creditors, the value which is payable to them The liquidation value distributed as per the liquidation waterfall mechanism is the only amount payable to them as a floor price. The larger concept of the distribution of resolution proceeds amongst these creditors is that this mechanism, if followed by all the stakeholders of the company, a concept of deemed fairness and equity has been brought into the code, which says that this mechanism needs to be followed, and if followed, it will result in a fair and equitable distribution. Now, moving on from this method of distribution, we come to the decision as to who gets how much, or how are the distribution proceeds or the resolution proceeds distributed amongst the various categories of creditors. The code also has brought in an amendment by which the committee of creditors has been given the power to take into consideration the method and manner in which the resolution proceeds are being distributed amongst various categories. And one of those considerations, very importantly, is the fact whether the creditors have a security, the priority of the security, and the value of the security. Now, this is something which is new, which had been talked about by various stakeholders for a long time, and we need to understand more about how this will play out. So here, maybe I can bring in Simon. And Simon, so the concept of secured and unsecured financial creditors and the distinction between them, right from the threshold or the CIRP process rather than only at the liquidation process, this is something that people have been talking about, and we are getting a glimpse of that under the code. So how do you think this will play out?
So you're right, Arjun. I think right from the start, there was always been a concern as to whether financial creditors should be treated alike, whether a secured creditor should be given preference over an unsecured creditor, and really what is the value of the debt vis-a-vis a secured creditor as opposed to an unsecured creditor. Now, I think nothing in the law forbids a resolution applicant from making this distinction, even today. But I think it is a welcome change to see that the code sort of recognizes this, in addition to just the liquidation waterfall proceeds, where a secured and an unsecured creditor are placed on different pedestals. The code now also sort of looks to perhaps give resolution applicants the ability to suggest in their plans a distinction between priority to a secured creditor and an unsecured creditor. Even there, a distinction is also sought to be made with respect to priority of charge, which is sort of a gray area in the entire code as to whether, you know, how do you look at priority of charge. And the typical concern or typical issue that always existed is a first charge holder should be on a better footing than a second charge holder. And I think the code now is trying to allow for that to happen. Now, at the end of the day, you always have to go back to a committee of creditors that is comprised till now of financial creditors, as well as financial creditors secured or unsecured, as one bucket. So they still have to approve it, and the voting share percentage has not changed. So you still have to go back to the same financial creditors on the same pedestal to approve it. But can the applicant now make a determination, distinction, and can is there a distinction that can be drawn between secured and unsecured and priority of charge? The answer to that is yes.
So, Simon, a follow-up question on this. I think the biggest change which this code had originally brought in was this folding up of secured and unsecured, and no concept of first charge, second charge whatsoever. And they were all treated at par. And in fact, there is a jurisprudence now already created that the way the code reads, you cannot make any distinction in terms of the resolution plan or the payments made under the resolution plan between these categories. That doesn't change. That remains intact. What they have brought in, or I may say they have not come out in open through a via media in an explanation, is to say that COC, while approving, will look at the aspects of
security or priority. What is your thought on this? Is this even practically possible, or this is just a provision which will never stand scrutiny because the code itself has not changed vis-a-vis treating them at par? Or do you think this is an opening to a larger debate where secure creditors may get much better share as we go along with this IBC in near future?
So that's a good question, Vyapak, and I think it's an opening door. I'm sure it'll be litigated, but you also have to look at the amendments which now try to curb litigation timelines. So whether this will really see a large debate in a court of law within the scope of the amendments itself is a question mark. But to my mind, it is an opening in the larger scheme of things, where now a distinction is they're trying to sort of draw a distinction between a better placed creditor, financial creditor, as opposed to a worst placed financial creditor, and you know how this will play out in the resolution plans is yet to be seen, but I think the one sort of criteria which continues to remain the same is that the voting percentages or the voting thresholds continue to remain equal for all, and therefore a secured creditor perhaps may not have a larger voting share, or the value of its debt is not treated differently with respect to voting percentages. So one way or the other, there is a balance in terms of how this needs to be looked at, but is this an opening to perhaps more amendments to create a disparity between secured, unsecured, first charge, second charge? The answer to that is probably yes.
So taking a little different point on the same issue, and maybe Arjun or Kamran, you can come in, is earlier, and again, this code is unique in itself because unlike a liquidation event where law prescribes how the monies will be distributed, here a resolution applicant decides how the monies will be distributed. And now, the earlier at least, it was not clear that how much one can interfere with what resolution applicant has decided for each of the category of creditors. But now there is a larger role prescribed to at least COC, where it shied off by just saying feasibility and viability earlier. Now it talks about looking at little more in a little larger role, where you take into account the priority and the security and so on and so forth. So it's almost like they can comment on it, or they may even alter it, or you know, we don't know how it will develop over a period of time. Is this a significant change, or you think this was anyways done and now it's codified?
So, Vyapak, I think it's quite significant from the perspective of where this amendment has been introduced and what are the practical implications of this strategic introduction, if I may put it, from a future challenge perspective. Because if you see, the amendment has been introduced in a sphere where it becomes a commercial discretion of the committee of creditors to either to confirm or alter a proposal being made by the resolution applicant. And this confirmation being provided by the committee of creditors is basis certain considerations, including the value of security. So if we have a situation where the amount being apportioned towards a creditor as per the total percentage of the dues owed to it is lesser than some other person who has a larger value of the chunk of security, then they can alter these permutations and combinations. Now, why it is important that this is a commercial consideration is because the Supreme Court has already in one of its judgments said that a decision being taken by the Committee of Creditors in its commercial wisdom does not stand open to judicial scrutiny. So in this kind of a situation, if there is a confirmation basis, a reasoned recorded confirmation by the Committee of Creditors after taking into account these considerations, maybe the door does not stand open anymore to further challenge before an adjudicatory authority. So from here on, if we just move a little towards one of the more complicated issues surrounding the payment being made two categories of creditors and operational creditors and dissenting financial creditors. What we have seen is some of the litigations, for example, the SR litigation, which has been going on for more than 600 days, the reason of this litigation is the manner in which the resolution proceeds have been provided to operational creditors who have challenged the resolution plan, saying that we are being given nil as compared to a 92 or 99% being given to other creditors. Now, we have a change in the way amounts are being given to operational creditors. So maybe, Vyapak, could you simplify this entire situation for us?
Sure. So I think the code, in my view, though there are several provisions and procedures, in a simplistic way, the code is divided into two. One, who suggests a plan and who approves it. So suggestion of the plan is clearly from the resolution applicant. He decides who gets what. And who approves it is only the financial creditor comprising of secured and unsecured creditors. So this is one part of the code. And we just discussed as to what are the issues and what are the challenges in not including operational creditors as part of this group of decision makers at COC, and what are the challenges of giving a full right to a resolution applicant to decide not only what he will give or that company will give, but also decide who will get what out of that amount. So that is one part, and we just discussed, Simon and Arjun explained that. The second part of this code is what is fair and how the distribution of this money should be made amongst the creditors, whether secured, unsecured, operational, government, so on and so forth. And there is a clear departure from the provisions of Section 53, which is part of the code, which only applies when companies goes into liquidation if the restructuring fails. Now, this is one instance where they have, in a way, lifted the provisions of Section 53 and brought in into the part of restructuring as well, to bring in some kind of fairness and equity as a principle in terms of the distribution waterfall between secured, unsecured, operational, and very, I would say, it's unusual in that sense that they have again brought in the fourth category of distribution, which is the dissenting creditors as part of COC. Now, let me take up the dissenting creditors as part of COC first. This is a clear case of a flip-flop. There was a category on dissenting creditors in the code when it was introduced. Then jurisprudence came in that you cannot bifurcate or differentiate between dissenting and assenting creditors. And then the code modified and deleted those provisions. And now they are again brought in. What basically it does, which I don't know what is real objective and what it will actually achieve, but what it simply does is they are creating a fourth category of creditors, which is dissenting creditors. And as part of COC, whoever is saying no to a plan, and still if 66% says yes and plan goes through, then that dissenting creditor gets only a portion of the value offered by the resolution applicant, to the extent if the same value is given to a dissenting creditor as per liquidation value, and the distribution waterfall will be as per the Section 53 and where that creditor falls, either secured or unsecured. Now, what does it achieve? Does it make a dissenting creditor little worried about saying no? Are we not allowing somebody fairly saying yes or no? Because if 66 says yes, he's basically penalized for saying no. So I don't know what was the objective behind this. Yes, there are instances that practically which happened in Dirty Dozen, but I don't know whether that required any amendment again to bring back what was originally deleted. Before going to the second aspect of operational creditor, maybe I'll bring in Simone if she has any specific thought on this whole aspect of dissenting creditors and penalizing them.
Yeah, so Vyapak, I think in the zeal of the government to perhaps try to get a resolution plan approved as early as possible, I think there is a sort of a penalty that is imposed on somebody that dissents. And it's unique in the sense that this dissenting financial creditor will really only get liquidation value as opposed to just, you know, regular proceeds of the as per the waterfall. So I think maybe it's a miss, or because an operational creditor can get the higher of liquidation value or the proceeds as per 53. In for a descending financial creditor, it is really only the liquidation value. So on the one hand, if for instance, you know, you're trying to sort of distinguish between a secured and unsecured creditor. A secure creditor that perhaps, you know, where the liquidation value is large and has a larger stake, a secured creditor may stand to gain in limited circumstances. But in general circumstances, as we've seen liquidation value of these companies being quite low as opposed to the resolution plan value, in more circumstances than not, the financial creditor is likely to sort of, or the dissenting financial creditor is likely to lose. And therein also lies a little bit of an anomaly, because on the one hand, you already have a threshold which was lowered to 66% to approve of a financial of a resolution plan. So if you are sort of not allowed to dissent, then the threshold of 44 and 66 becomes a little less meaningful in the zeal of maybe getting a RP, you know, done in place. So I think, you know, this may see a little bit of debate and concern with financial sort of creditors. Although you may also sort of look at the positive, being that you perhaps might be able to get a resolution plan out faster and achieve the objective of getting things done at the earliest possible.
Yeah, and shifting a little bit on operational creditors, there is, I think, if I may put it, that which is the single largest point of debate, discussions and litigations as far as resolution plan is concerned, I think it is the value prescribed to the operational creditors, because most of the plans have given them nil or very small portion of the value provided by the resolution applicant. And while the law reads in one way, but the larger thought is that operational creditors who otherwise are running the company, right? They are providing goods, they are providing services, they are basically participating hand in hand with the promoters and the company, are getting nothing out of the resolution plan, while financial creditors, both unsecured and secured, are given primacy, and they may be getting 60, 70, 80% of the value. Now, one way to look at it is, yes, the whole IBC was to bring out the NPAs out of banks, but then you are creating more NPAs in form of operational creditor companies, which may be small and medium size enterprises, service providers, who, if they don't get anything out of this, obviously will go into liquidation sooner or later. So with that introduction, what happened as part of this amendment and a direct consequence of SR is that there was always a debate where operational creditors in SR got zero and then increased to almost 59%, which is now challenged in Supreme Court as to what they should get and what secured creditors should get. This code brings in a concept of deemed fair and equitable treatment. What is reasonable for the purposes of payment to operational creditor under the plan? And the simple formula that they have prescribed is they again have looked into the waterfall mechanism under the liquidation process, section 53, and they said you give higher of one, the liquidation value if distributed as per section 53, or the resolution applicant offer again distributed as per the waterfall mechanism under Section 53, which means that even if the first and the second value is zero, which means zero or zero, whatever is higher, and you offer zero to operational creditors, the law says that is fair and equitable. And again, there can be situations and situations, but in a normal circumstances, if the secured creditors and unsecured creditors as part of financial creditors are not going to get full 100% of their value as part of the resolution applicant, we think most of the cases, both the amounts will be zero or zero, whichever is higher. And then it will be treated as fair and equitable for operational creditors. Will this end the litigation on reasonableness as to how operational creditors are concerned? We don't know. But that is the law. Now, forgetting a little bit about law, maybe Arjun or Simon, is this fair and equitable, though the law prescribes it as fair and equitable?
So I'll just maybe start and Simon can add, but maybe it's time for us to take another look at the entire dispute and controversy with respect to how much is being paid to operational creditors. Obviously, there is a direct conflict between two categories. Operational creditors are saying we can't survive if you give us nil, and financial creditors are saying that, you know, we deserve adequate returns for our investments and the security that we hold. But I think where the problem lies is not with the benchmark value which is being distributed amongst the categories. It's not whether you are taking liquidation value as the benchmark or fair value or the resolution plan value. It doesn't matter which benchmark you start from. If you link the payment to operational creditors to the distribution waterfall prescribed for liquidation, then at the end of the day, considering that operational creditors fall last, you will almost always have a negligible or nil value left for them to receive. Keeping that in mind, if we try to de-link the amounts payable to operational creditors from this distribution waterfall and try to think of some other mechanism, then maybe one mechanism that people can contemplate about using is linking the amount payable to operational creditors directly as a pro rata or percentage basis of the amount which is being paid to the financial creditors
on a pro rata basis.
So the financial creditors at the end of the day are receiving a proposal from the resolution applicant and thereafter being confirmed by the COC. So the financial creditors themselves are okay with the amount that is being paid to them.
So sorry to interject, sure. But going back to Simon, what you started, who has the right to decide if 100 is the value offered by the resolution applicant? Who has the right to distribute amongst financial creditors, secured, unsecured, and operational? Can law give it so open-ended to resolution applicant, or it should prescribe some waterfall mechanism?
So Vyapak, I think, look, there's a strong debate, and this is completely sort of 180 degrees from what the NCLAT has held, right, with respect to the SR situation, where you've tried to draw no distinction between operational creditors and financial creditors. From there, we've come to a situation where, you know, the actual intent of the law, as the legislators have thought about it, has been clarified now. But I think whilst, you know, the entire law, the entire sort of country is gearing up towards ensuring that financial creditors and banks, etc., remain healthy and don't take too much of a downfall, one stakeholder that, you know, needs to be taken into consideration, because at the end of the day, that stakeholder is also a primary revenue earner, generator for another bank, right, is the operational creditor. And therefore, since there is nobody at the seat in the COC taking care of its interests, you know, perhaps the law needs to provide something more to the operational creditor than just providing liquidation value or you know, as the law is currently prescribed. So I think given this dichotomy, where even the RP also has no right to say anything because the law deems it to be fair, you know, whether the operational creditor has absolutely no stake to make a decision, and nobody to sort of take care of what the operational creditor should get is a little bit of a question mark.
Sure. So, Kamran, coming to you, and the ghost of retrospectivity in every law is becoming more and more relevant and alive, and it has also hit IBC and this amendment. So, particularly on the issue of the distribution between creditors, can you give your, you know, final view on that, and maybe post that we'll open up the questions for the floor, and depending upon the questions, we'll take other topics.
Right. So, what the amendments also now propose is that the distribution waterfall, the distribution that are now contemplated in the resolution plan, should be made effective retrospectively, which means that it will these provisions or the amendments would apply to all resolution plans that have not been approved by the NCLT, or if any resolution plan has been approved by NCLT and which is still in appeal, even those to those resolution plans, this mechanism will apply to, or if any resolution plan is challenged before any court or legal proceeding, then again, this mechanism, the new mechanism, will apply to those resolution plans. While the intent behind is great.
Sorry to interject, Kamran. Let me ask you a straight question. Will this apply to SR, and therefore you will not need a hearing before Supreme Court?
Well, the answer, I would again take you back to the law, and the law on retrospective applicability is that if it affects substantive rights, then it should be clarified that it applies retrospectively, and it is actually clarified that it is applying retrospectively, and that will be my answer to that.
Okay. So with that, Kamran, any other final view on that? Otherwise, we'll open the floor for questions.
No, but I think there's one sort of issue that at least, given that it is retrospective in nature, at least there's only going to be one school of thought and one sense of jurisprudence that will develop. Otherwise, what would have happened is there would be two sets of jurisprudences with respect to operational creditors, pre-amendment and post-amendment, which really wouldn't really be healthy for this environment. So I think on the one hand, I think the retrospective nature may sort of, you know, add to the objective of this code, is to get things done speedily.
Sure. Thanks a lot. So can we open the floor for questions, comments, views?
Thank you very much. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask the question may press star and 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and 2. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. A reminder, you may press star and 1 to ask the question. The first question is from the line of Uday Bajaj from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Okay, so when we're talking about Section 53 and distribution of proceeds in respect of under this particular section, I think the view which we got from the team at NDA was that in accordance with the waterfall, it's going to be the secured creditors, which would sort of end up absorbing the, whether it's the distribution amount or liquidation amount, they would sort of end up absorbing most of the recovery. And when you keep going down, you can sort of anticipate that the operational creditors would either get nil or negligible amount. So my question is, now when you're looking at the distribution to the secured creditors, as let's say, and let's forget workmen's dues and all these other things, when you're looking at distribution to the secured creditor, what amount are you attributing as being distributable to the secured creditor under Section 53? Is it the amount which they can keep absorbing till the time that they get fully repaid, or is it the liquidation value of the particular assets on which the secured creditors have security? Because If it is the latter, then I don't think the conclusion that the OCs or the unsecured creditors would nearly always get zero or negligible would stand, because clearly there is a lot more when you're in most of the resolution plans, when you're actually transferring assets and you're transferring a going concern to a new acquirer, they're actually paying for the going concern value, right?
Yeah.
So that going concern value, how that is to be distributed, yeah, is not coming out very clearly.
Sure. I get your point. So obviously, you know, certain companies may have larger value even beyond what is just secured as part of security. So there can be, you know, different situations. But in principle, 53 applies where secured creditors are deemed, or at least would have been deemed to have relinquished its security and would participate as part of liquidation process. So what typically would happen is that, let's say, and now we are talking about either the operational creditors or the dissenting financial creditors. So what it says that assume, let's say, the value prescribed or offered by the resolution applicant is 100. And if that 100 was to be distributed as per 53, right? And if as per the value to secured creditors after relinquishing the security, whatever is the total amount, how much will go as part of distribution? Because it's not pro rata, right? It is one after the another. And therefore, what we expect is that value in a situation where the company is anyways at one end, possibly the actual debts may be 600, 700, 800, the liquidation value may be even lower than, let's say, 100, and the offer is 100 or 200 or 300 or whatever. And that amount may not really percolate all the way down to operational creditors, because we may forget workmen, let's say in your example, but then there are government dues in between. There is unsecured creditors in between. So yes, there can be a one-off situation where security to secured creditors or the portion of secured creditors is not that large enough to fill up the category there, and there would be some overflow. But again, we expect that it is unlikely, or at least in very, very few instances, that operational creditor will even get anything. The point is not what they will get, frankly, Uday. The point is whatever that number is, 0, 1, 2, 3, right? Now the law says that is fair and equitable, which means that the operational creditor cannot challenge on the basis of unreasonableness. That is the point, which was up for challenge, and NCLTs or NCLATs were taking their own view depending upon the plan, depending upon how much of how much is paid to secured creditors, what is the other situational circumstances of the company and the plan, and so forth. So I think that's the point, but point well taken what you say, that there can be a situation, but in my view, very unlikely.
Yeah, so I know there, if you just look at it, right, if you look at the way the waterfall has to actually work, it's all dues to the financial creditor. Now, the minute you have a haircut, right, the minute you say secured creditors are going to get 80% of the amounts due, and that the resolution applicant is paying, say, X for the company, and in that X, the financial creditors are already taking a haircut, then really there is nothing else due elsewhere, right? Because you've already used up the entire 100. So therefore, if you see most of the RPs, there's always a haircut, some sort of haircut here or there. The minute the financial creditors have taken a haircut, that means the amounts due to them, whatever it is, have not been paid in full. If it's not been paid in full, then it just stops at the financial creditors.
Yeah.
And therefore, our view is that the OCs would get, you know, less or nothing. In a situation where financial creditors are getting 100% dues, then of course there's, you know, plenty for everybody else to participate.
Sure. Maybe we can move to the next question, Uday, if you are okay.
No, I hear you. And thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the question.
Thank you. A reminder to all the participants, you may press star and one to ask a question. The next question is from the line of Sharon Digama from ICICI Prudential Asset Management. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to check one thing with that whether the...
Sorry to interrupt you, ma'am. There's a lot of disturbance coming from your background.
Just a moment, sorry. Yeah, so will a financial creditor who is abstaining from voting be considered as a dissenting creditor?
So how it usually works is that this was something that has been discussed in various jurisprudence as to how to consider someone who is absenting, whether they are dissenting or not. They usually take it to be that that person hasn't given a view, and therefore the total pool for the COC is reduced to the number which is without that, and then they go ahead
present
with
and
present and voting, and then they go ahead with the process.
But then what value will the such a creditor get paid? Will he get paid the liquidation value?
So it says dissenting specifically. It doesn't say non-approving. So therefore, I think you can read into that law to say that
and
it's not really a dissenting.
As,
and
considered as approving.
Correct. And just, So should not be considered as dissenting. But again, this is subject to, you know, interpretation, judicial interpretation for the...
Yeah, most likely they will get it.
Correct.
No. So then what is the benefit? Because if they, then any dissenting creditor also will just want to abstain from voting, then what's the point of having a dissenting?
No, so then dissenting creditor, in sense, who wants to dissent and would not dissent, is basically allowing the present and voting to go ahead and see. Idea of dissenting is to see if you can garner more than 33% to let the plan fail, right? So by not going, you are not achieving your objective.
Correct. So if 45% of the entire creditors dissent, right, the plan doesn't go through. So therefore, you know, if you want to have a plan that goes through or doesn't want to stop the plan, you have to dissent. Now it depends on which side of the fence you really are, right? And therefore, the role of a dissenting creditor is important. But in a situation where you see that 66% of the financial creditors are anyway assenting, then there is no real point in dissenting in any event.
Yeah, because if you actually go and dissent, then you will be in the category where you are getting liquidation value.
Correct. So there's no point. And I suppose one way to read this interpretation is to see, is to ensure that, you know, creditors like this, once an RFP has been approved by 66%, don't really go and litigate and, you know, try and thwart the process, right? That's, I suppose, the ultimate intent of this clause.
Sure.
But I just wanted to understand. So then if a person is abstaining, so since he's not specifically dissenting, then can he go and further appeal against the resolution plan?
The answer has to be no. Nobody can stop someone from appealing, but I really doubt if the courts would interfere for a person who has not exercised his rights when required to.
Okay. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Sharon. Can we go to the third question?
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Nishtha Narang from Wellspun Group. Please go ahead.
Thank you, panel, for this webinar. I have my question on Section 31, the proposed amendment, which includes central government, state government, and local authority to whom a debt in respect of the payment of dues. So a resolution plan is now, once approved, is made binding on these authorities as well. Now my question is divided into two parts. The first part being, what about the dues which have not surfaced as yet? However, they pertain to a period prior to the plan approval date and are not subsumed under the resolution plan because they are not a part of the plan as such today. Second question is with respect to claims which are contingent. How will they be treated by virtue of this amendment?
Sure. So I think what has not surfaced obviously can't be treated or considered to be treated, right? And this is a plan where you are taking a company on a going concern. So again, these are all views and therefore you have to treat it that way. But in my view, if the claim itself surfaces post the plan being approved, unless the plan sometimes even says, you know, in relation to the past dues or past period. There are the people have now started writing plans much more elaborately than, you know, what we can expect. But if the plan is silent about any such prior period or past period claims, then in my view, those claims will have to be adhered by the new management which takes over the bankrupt companies. And your second question is what happens to contingent liabilities. Again, we have seen plans which actually deals with that and say these are, if they are part of the balance sheet, they actually deal with it. If they don't deal with it, then as and when they become real, the new management will have to deal with it.
So just to add to what Vyapak has just already mentioned, we have actually seen many NCLAT judgments in which they are dealing with contingent liabilities in respect of litigations where there has been no final conclusion to, let's say, an arbitration which was pending at the point of time when the insolvency process had commenced, and therefore it was suspended due to the moratorium. The NCLAT, basically what it is saying is that these proceedings can be reinitiated once the moratorium is lifted post approval and implementation of the resolution plan. Because if you see section 60 of the code also specifically states that the limitation period with respect to these adjudicatory proceedings will stand in abeyance and will not effectively bar anyone from continuing these proceedings.
Right.
So with respect to contingent liabilities, yes, they are being allowed to be continued with the new management and the new ownership.
And just to again add, but we have also seen plans dealing with contingent liabilities in two ways. One, sometimes they actually says that this pending litigations will be treated as extinguished. And those plans have been actually approved. What happens in the before those adjudicating authorities of those claims, we don't know. But actually, such plans have been approved. And some plans are even smarter, which says that though these proceedings may continue after we take over the new or as a new management, but as and when they win, they will be treated and paid as per the percentage paid to such category. Suppose it's an operational creditor claim and
sure,
they win 100, they will get 30 because they are only given 30 as per this plan. So people have you know, treated this very, very uniquely in different plans.
Sure, thank you.
Thanks for your question. Can we move to the next question?
Sure, thank you. The next question is from the line of Yukti Sharma from Piramal Capital and Housing Finance. Please go ahead.
Yes, Yukti.
Ms. Sharma, your line is in talk mode. May I request you to unmute your line from your side and go ahead with your question?
Hello. Yeah, hi. Yukti is not here, but I am from her team.
Sure.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi.
Can you introduce yourself?
The secured creditor, how is it defined? If I have a third-party security, will I be treated as secured creditor? Because the definition of secured creditor covers third-party security also. There is a distinction between the security which is given by a debtor or third-party. Whereas if I see section 52, which is again covered in section 53, it says that a security bid is relinquished and if it goes into liquidation asset of the debtor. So there I feel that under section 52 and 53, they are referring to a secured creditor where the creditor has where the secured creditor has a security from debtor, not from a third party.
That's correct.
So will I be treated? So there was an amendment which we discussed right now. It said that the resolution applicant may discriminate between a secured creditor or unsecured creditor while distributing the money. So the resolution applicant will treat the third party security secured creditor as a secured creditor or not? Will he refer to the definition or to the intent of section 53?
So I don't think these provisions change the relationship, right? which is created in past because of, you know, whatever transaction, and the provision which talked about you know, creating differentiation between secured and unsecured is, as we told earlier, it's not really creating a differentiation. It's a backdoor suggestion that there can be a differentiation created, but the biggest problem is the code in itself is very clear, and jurisprudence is very clear that you cannot make a distinction between a secured and unsecured creditor as far as the treatment of payment which is made under the resolution plan. So so I don't think situation changes in the example you gave, because it does not affect the original relationship with the created between the debtor and the creditor. And 52 and 53, as you rightly said, only applies to a direct secured creditor holding security interest for a debt given to the debtor or the borrower company under restructuring.
So if the resolution applicant is giving priority to a creditor who is having a direct security and not giving priority to a creditor having a third party security, will he be justified, will the plan be justified saying that this is a fair and equitable as per this amendment?
See, I think let's take a step back. The relationship, security, no security, unsecured, third party, none of those changes, right? The point is only whether they are a financial creditor or not a financial creditor, right? And whether under restructuring or whether under liquidation, how they would be treated, whether they would fall under the category of secured creditor. If they fall under the category of secured creditor, they would be treated at par. If they don't fall under the category of secured creditor, then they don't fall under the line at which they have to be treated at par with the other financial creditors of the company. So frankly speaking, whatever that situation was even before this code, even in winding up earlier or other relationship, none of that changes just because of this code or these amendments in 2019.
Okay. Thank you.
We didn't get your name. Sorry, can you introduce yourself?
I'm Premit Chopra from Piramal Capital.
Thanks for your question. We can move to the next question.
You. The next question is from the line of Sati Mukund from Barclays Bank. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was just looking at the percentages on the class of committee of creditors, which now they've said if you have a majority in that particular class, then they can then go ahead and communicate. And I think rightly during the session it was pointed out that debenture trustees as a debenture holders as a class also have another trustee documentation that they have a particular and most probably 75% debenture holders consent to do anything. But then by virtue of this particular amendment, it's overriding the contractual agreement between the parties.
That's true. You have identified a real situation, and we have in fact seen this situation even for FCCB bonds or trustee agreements where you know, the underlying documents may say 60%, 70%, sometimes even 90%. But now what has happened is if they are categorized in one class, then even if there are, let's say, 2-3 kinds of bondholders having 90, 70, whatever different kinds of percentages, but for the purpose of saying yes or no to such a plan under the law, so long as 50% or above says yes, then the whole class and the value ascribed to that whole class will be treated as part of 66% saying yes. Yes, that's in a way departure to the financial provisions, but I guess that's where it stands post this amendment.
Yeah, I think it also depends on how, you know, these the representative will be appointed, right? Will be, for instance, in an FCCB situation where you already have a trustee, will different trustees together, different classes of trustees, be represented by one another trustee, or will it be just the trustee that is currently currently the FCCB trustee. So I think this has to sort of play out, because if, for instance, there is one representative of FCCBs and there are, say, five series of FCCBs, right, and one trustee is going to be representing all, then technically speaking, the trustee would have to be the representative of the already existing trustees. So each trustee would then have to take approvals under its FCCB documents, and these collective trustees would have to give authority to the to
one
the representative. Yeah. So then in that situation, you wouldn't really have a distinction between the documents as well as the law. So it has to play out really.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. It could be all the FCCB holders or the debenture holders can be a particular class.
Yeah.
So it could be a 50% out of that class, and
that's
I think that will have to actually
will have to take 50% of its.
Also, debenture. You have to see where this amendment has come from, right? I think they are looking at home buyers and that kind of category where you just don't know out of few hundred people how do you take vote from each. And then count each vote yes and no. So I think they are you are trying to address some problem whereby creating another where you will have to then clarify that where there is a contractual arrangement already between the class, then that will prevail. And you know there is no end to it. But you are absolutely right. This is where
it
stands
today.
Yeah. Today. I think.
And actually what I was thinking is then the future documentation that we do now, so what is that we must actually look into? Because it
yeah,
becomes
I think,
really
to be very to be very frank, IBC has practically changed every document in deal making, so a lot of work for lawyers, if I may say so.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And honestly, it's a moving target, so you know, it's going to change depending on the nature of time.
Thanks a lot for your question. Can we move to the next question?
Sure. Thank you very much. The next question is from the line of Devanshu Sood from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Devanshi.
Hi. Devanshi. I think this has kind of already been answered, but. What now happened in, do these amendments in any way affect the claims of operational creditors who had secured claims already? Is it changing anything for them? Because they already had secured liabilities with firms which are being liquidated.
Yeah, so as we were talking about the retrospective applicability of these provisions, there is a clear demarcation of where these provisions will apply. Basically, anything and everything which is yet not implemented as a starting point, these provisions will apply. Post liquidation or post implementation, obviously, it will not be reopened. But and again, frankly speaking, the provision is only vis-a-vis what is fair and equitable. I don't think this is opening up the percentage in a real sense. What it is saying is, so long as that percentage is higher of one or two, as explained earlier, you are not changing that number. But that would be deemed to be fair, whatever that number is. You can't keep saying this is unfair or unreasonable or not equitable and things like that. So this is targeted more for less litigation rather than really helping somebody getting more or less depending on this plan.
Sure. Just to kind of follow up on that, when the definition of fair and equitable plays out, because this will in itself put the secured creditors at a lower footing. So the question of being fair and equitable, how do you see that playing
really
out?
Look, it really comes in the operational creditors distribution, right? And it says vis-a-vis if it's done in this manner, then it is deemed fair and equitable, because the entire SR judgment was whether the fair treatment was given to all creditors, right? And if you look at the IBC as a court in its entirety, there are instances where equitable treatment and fair, that the has to be fair, et cetera, is built in. These are subjective terms built in. So I think to address those issues
and
concerns.
And bring objectivity.
They said, look, if you followed this process, it is deemed fair and equitable, full stop. there's nothing else to discuss. Sure. So they've tried to bring about an objective sentence in a subjective criteria.
So thanks, Mr. Sood.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we move to the next question?
Sure. A reminder to all the participants, you may press star and one to ask a question. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one. The next question is from the line of Nishant Kulhari from IG. Please go ahead.
Hi, panel. Thank you so much for your insightful thoughts. My question is slightly in relation to the amendments which have also come into the regulations, where we see somewhat a backdoor entry being given to the promoters of the corporate debtor. Right, so they have been given a chance to go under the compromise arrangement under the Section 230 of the Companies Act. So what are your thoughts on that vis-a-vis the 29A under the CIRP?
So if you see, 29A is actually not only applicable to CIRP, but also to the liquidation proceedings as well, right? Because even under the liquidation proceedings, it says that anybody who's not otherwise eligible to participate in the CIRP process cannot participate in the liquidation process. What you say about Section 230 and the manner in which 230 will play out, like you would appreciate that this is actually coming from judicial interpretation of the liquidation proceedings, where they have said that let's try to first see if the outstanding dues are can be restructured in any manner, and thereafter only try to liquidate and do a piecemeal sale of the company. But even at that stage, I think if there is as of now, I think the promoters have already been given a clear free hand to take the company out of the resolution process if they have the money to do so, and with no clear timelines, because the Supreme Court has said that you don't need to care about timelines. If you can file a 12A application and get 90% approval from the COC, then you can finish off the resolution process. So I don't think promoters would actually maybe wait till liquidation and 230 to do that, because again, they might get hit by the same eligibility criteria with no 12A allowed for them to again come into the resolution process. So I think maybe the promoters would try to take the company out at the CIRP process itself and not wait for liquidation.
Okay, so basically then this gives the promoters a chance before getting into the IBC and directly going into compromise or arrangement with the creditors under 230. Then under IBC coming into, if a liquidation order is passed, again they would have a chance to do so. Is that the case?
That's a possibility, but I think
we'll have to see how it turns out.
But that's definitely a possibility.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for your question.
The next question is from the line of Jaydeep Mehta from Lex Street Advisors. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello. Under the amended Section 5, in case if NCLT approves a resolution plan involving restructuring of the corporate debtor, whether by merger, amalgamation or demerger, whatever it is, so in that case, will it be considered as a deemed approval under the Companies Act also, or separate procedure will have to be followed?
No. Luckily, the answer is very short. Yes.
Yeah. In fact, it tries to avoid double approvals, and I think it's a one window clearance. So yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Mr. Mehta.
Thank you.
Yes.
A reminder to all the participants: anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one. Ladies and gentlemen, you may press star and one to ask the question.
So if there are no further questions, then maybe we close here.
Sure. As there are no further questions, I will now hand the conference over to Mr. Vyapak Desai for closing comments.
Yeah, I think, frankly, the way the conference call has gone and the participation and the overwhelming response that we have received, I think only comment I have is that we'll be back soon talking about this because this is just the bill. It will come into force very soon, but I'm sure this will get tested in courts sooner than we think. So we'll be waiting for getting back to this group and having your views and discussing these issues. Thanks a lot, everyone, to join. Thanks, Simon, Kamran, and Arjun. Till the next time, thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much. On behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines. Thank you.